Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Chemotherapy, radiation, hormone treatments, surgery. Essentially, chemicals, high energy, or cutting. Those were the only treatment options available to cancer patients for a long, long time. But that changed when a new idea took hold. Can the body's own immune system be harnessed to fight cancer? Well, this month, American and Japanese researchers were awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine for their work revolutionizing the use of immunotherapy in fighting cancer. It's costly and carries significant side effects, but it has also dramatically extended the lives of some patients, which is why there's more excitement than ever around immunotherapies. So this hour on Point, we'll explore where we are now and what's next in cancer research. And you can join us. What impact has cancer had on your family? Have you undergone immunotherapy treatments? What was it like? And what changes in cancer treatment do you hope to see in the future? What is your question for some of the world's best cancer researchers? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. As I said, we're going to be joined today by some of the world's best cancer researchers, and we will start in Houston, Texas, with Jim Allison. He is the winner of the 2018 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for his work in cancer immunotherapy. He shares the prize with Tasuku Honjo of Kyoto University in Japan. And Jim Allison is the chair of the Department of Immunology at MD Cancer Center. And Jim Allison, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here, Meghna.
First of all, a hearty congratulations to you. What does it feel like to be now be known worldwide as Nobel Prize-winning researcher Jim Allison?
Well, it's still kind of sinking in, to tell you the truth. It's just been a whirlwind of activity since the announcement was made a little over a week ago.
Yeah, I can imagine that it's been a very busy time for you. But I understand that, just sort of anecdotally, you found out that you'd won the Nobel Prize not from the Nobel Committee itself. How were you informed?
Yeah. Well, I got up in the morning really early and was kind of thinking that it wasn't going to happen, you know, because there had been a lot of buzz the week before. My wife said, well, it looked like it's going to be next year, and you know, because the phone hadn't rung yet. And then it rang, and it was my son, and said, Dad, you won. And then my phone said, there's another call from Sweden. So I said, I got to go.
There's another call from Sweden, yeah.
Yeah. They had some trouble. I don't know. They didn't have my phone number or something.
It's interesting, this day and age, the Nobel Committee sometimes has trouble reaching out to people who they have deemed have changed the world here. Now, you mentioned your wife. I should mention her as well. She's a co-researcher with you in these cancer immunotherapies, right? Padmini Sharma, right?
Yes, we work together. And she's a genitourinary oncologist here at MD Anderson. And together we run a group called the Immunotherapy Platform, where we're trying to really, you know, understand the impact of these new drugs on the immune system and how they interact with each other, and trying to optimize the treatments to make them more effective for more people.
I see. Okay. Well, so let's talk a little bit then about the actual research itself. When we say cancer immunotherapy, I mean, sort of give us the biology 101 explanation of that. What are we talking about?
Well, there are actually several kinds of immunotherapy. All the way from, you know, growing cancer-specific cells called T cells that are actually the soldiers of the immune system. You know, you can grow them up in large numbers, take them from a patient, grow them up, get the right kind, put them back in. But what I developed was a little bit different. I'm really a basic immunologist at heart and have been working on T cells ever since I found out about them in the late 60s and trying to figure out how they work. And they're amazingly complex. When you first look at it, but once you start taking it apart, it's actually not all that complicated. But what we do is develop a way to take the brakes off the immune system. It's a fairly complicated process, but not all that bad. The first step is a thing called the T cell antigen receptor. It's a molecule on the surface of of these T cells that go all over the body looking for things that, you know, shouldn't be there and try to eliminate them. But this antigen receptor is what allows the T cell to know that something, you know, is wrong, you know, and gives a signal. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of just like the ignition switch in a car. You know, every T cell has a different one, but turning that on doesn't make it go anywhere. There's another molecule, another signal called a co-stimulatory signal that we showed in the late 80s is given by a molecule called CD28. And this can really only be provided by very specialized cells called dendritic cells that Ralph Steinman at Rockefeller University got the Nobel Prize several years ago.
Right.
So one of the things that we found was that tumor cells can't give that signal, and so they're kind of invisible to the immune system.
I see.
But it's actually more complex than that, because there's another molecule that is very much like CD28, but it acts like the brakes. And so, because when you turn T cells on, they start dividing very, very fast, you know, reproducing themselves to give you hundreds of thousands to millions, and you've got to do that within about a week or so, you know, deal with virus infections or cancer or whatever. But you've got to stop that process, and that's CTLA-4's job, is to stop that before it can cause any harm to normal cells. And since the tumors had a head start, as it turns out, T cells against tumors don't get primed or don't get the CD28 signal until they die for some reason and cause inflammation, and the immune system then gets alerted and starts the process. But if they start growing, and they've been growing for a while, so they've had a head start. So if CTLA, I just reasoned that maybe immunotherapies hadn't worked very well. And I reasoned that maybe the thing was is that if the tumor gets too big for you to get enough T cells to eliminate them before CTLA-4 turns them off, then the tumor wins. So we just disable the brakes for a while, figured out a way to just disable the brakes.
So if I may just jump in here with a sort of layperson summary of what you said, and tell me if I'm doing this right, that essentially part of the reason why immunotherapies beforehand perhaps weren't as effective is that, as you were saying, like there's something about tumor cells themselves that allowed the immune or inhibited T cells in the immune system from working, and you figured out a way to sort of turn on those T cells so that they could help essentially attack the tumors. Is that right?
Well, essentially, I mean, we figured out how to keep them from turning off.
Keep them from turning off. Okay.
Yeah.
So how revolutionary was this shift in thinking about what you could do with T cells? Has it really opened a door in terms of thinking about using the immune system as a primary means of attacking cancers?
Well, yes, it was quite revolutionary at the time, because what it involved was trying to target a molecule on the surface of T cells. It had nothing to do with cancer or the cancer cell.
Right.
And so when I started talking about this, all we got to do is unleash the T cells by blocking, you know, this molecule. People said, well, how can you treat cancer by ignoring the cancer?
Huh.
And I said, because the immune system doesn't know that it's necessarily cancer. It just knows it's a cell that's got stuff in it or on it that shouldn't be there. And so, and the beauty of that is, well, two things. One is, you know, it had a chance because you weren't targeting the cancer, work against any kind of cancer. And so, you know, that was, you know, sort of inherent in the model. And the other thing was, since the priming starts by tumor cell death, you can give even conventional therapies like radiation and chemotherapy some of the benefits of the immune responses. Mm-hmm. For example, one big one is when you've got T cells, you've got some for the rest of your life, and if the tumor happens to come back, the cells are already there, ready to go.
Right. Well, I want to talk more about sort of the positives and potential drawbacks of immunotherapy and treating cancer a bit later in the hour. But let me ask you, Jim Allison, do you remember the first patient that you worked with where you actually tried to see if it would make a difference in their lives and their treatment?
Well, there are actually two. The first I met was a woman, and I can use her name because she's given me permission, a woman named Sharon Belvin. And it's quite a touching story. I mean, I get choked up every time I talk about it or think about it. But she was 22 years old, had just gotten out of college, and was scheduled to be married when she was diagnosed with metastatic melanoma. And she had tumors in her lungs, 31, I believe was the count, and some on her skin, and then even one in her brain. And at the time, if you were diagnosed, this was about 2004, at the time, if you received that kind of diagnosis, the median survival was about 11 months. Mm-hmm. And there had been no drug that had ever, you know, improved that in a clinical trial. So she was told that she was basically, they tried a bunch of chemotherapy, and she, nothing worked. And finally they put her on one of the early trials of this drug, ipilimumab is what it's called, unfortunately. But her tumors went away within a few months. And I met her when she was visiting and, you know, or getting checked up, I should say. And her oncologist, Dr. Walchuk, said, your tumor's gone. We can't find anything. And I just moved there. Recently. Anyway, he called her and said, well, the guy who invented this is, I mean, he was with her, sorry. And he said, the guy who invented this is here. Do you want to meet him?
Huh.
Anyway, so Jed called me and said, come to the outpatient thing. And I said, well, I don't know, I'm busy. And I said, no, you got to come down here. And so I did, and she hugged me, and everybody started crying, and I cried. And that was the first time it really, you know, kind of dawned on me what was going on. And I talked with her occasionally after that, but about three or so years later, she sent me a photo of her first baby.
Wow.
And then it took a couple of years after that of her second baby. And so now she's basically 14 years out because the treatment was just given one round. And so she has a beautiful family now.
Wow. Well, we are talking with Jim Allison. He was awarded the 2018 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for his work in cancer immunotherapy. He shares that award with Tasuku Honjo of Kyoto University. And we're talking about where we are in terms of revolutionary treatments for cancer, their benefits. You just heard a huge benefit from Jim's story about the first patient treated with his research. But also we'll talk about the potential drawbacks as well. But why there's so much excitement around cancer and immunotherapy. Immunological treatments. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about where we are with cancer research and why there's so much excitement around immunological therapies for treating cancer. And we're joined today by the 2018 Nobel Prize winner in physiology or medicine. He's Jim Allison, and he shares that award with Tasuku Honjo of Kyoto University. His work in cancer immunotherapy was recognized by the Nobel Committee this year. And Jim Allison is also chair of the Department of Immunology at MD Cancer Center. And I want to bring in another voice into the conversation, Mr. Allison, if I could. Joining us now is Dr. Monica Bertagnoli. She is president of the American Society for Clinical Oncology. She's also chief of the Division of Surgical Oncology at Dana-Farber Brigham and Women's Hospital Cancer Center and a professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School as well. And she joins us today from Washington. Dr. Bertagnoli, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, you heard Jim Allison describe his research and also, meeting the first patient that he had met one-on-one who had undergone immunotherapy for her cancer. Really moving story. But I'm just wondering if you could sort of describe from the point of view of a fellow researcher, so sort of how revolutionary is it that we're thinking or focusing so much on using the immune system rather than external chemicals for treating cancer?
Well, you know, there is nothing more exciting to biologists, researchers in our field than to see something, some understanding from human biology finally reveal that we can really use it to help patients. And that was an incredibly moving story that, you know, fortunately, we're hearing lots of these stories. And, you know, it's a couple of decades now in the early 90s that there was the clue that the immune system could do this. There was some work done by Steven Rosenberg at the National Cancer Institute where he found that giving natural drugs called cytokines that could really jazz up the immune system could really eliminate tumors in patients with melanoma and renal cancers. And you know, it was just a glimmer that this might be possible. And then it took decades of really careful work in the laboratory and understanding the biology to really make this something that could help patients. And so it's just wonderful to see the Nobel Prize awarded in this field, and even better to see this brand new tool that we have to fight cancer.
Yeah. Now, we're talking about treatments and fighting cancer here. Is anyone thinking that immunotherapy might lead down to the root of a cure?
So we do see some cures from immunotherapy. What does cure mean? You know, to clinicians, cure means you have someone who has a tumor and you are somehow, something we can do, is able to eliminate that tumor and it doesn't come back in their body. That's what we mean by cure. And some of these initial immunotherapies, perhaps the patient that Dr. Allison just described, she lives her entire lifetime with this tumor never recurring. That's a cure. So clinicians are very cautious in using the cure word. But what really matters to patients is that they live a long, long life and never have the burden of cancer in their life. So that's what we're seeing, and we're seeing that with immunotherapy.
Okay. Jim Allison, let me turn back to you here. I mean, what do you think about what Dr. Bertagnoli has said? Should we be talking about potential cures?
Well, you know, for a long time it's been considered really, you know, inappropriate to use the words cancer and cure in the same sentence, but I agree with Dr. Bertagnoli. Melanoma patients that receive ipilimumab just as a single therapy, a single round of treatments, it's 4 injections, but about a little over 20% of them are alive at least 10 years after a single treatment. So as she was saying, I think that after a time, people can quit looking over their shoulder every day when they get up and wondering if the cancer is looming for them again and move on. I mean, that's what makes me so happy about Sharon's experience, because she was told by her physicians, don't have any children. Uh-huh. And after a while, finally, she said, no, I'm cured. I'm going to have my kids. I'm going to live a normal life.
Yeah. Monica Bertagnoli, how many immunotherapies are out there right now?
Well, we have 15 indications, so 15 specific cancer conditions that are now have drugs approved by the U.S. FDA for treatment using immunotherapies. But what's another fascinating thing about our field is there are literally thousands, last count about 2,000 different new immunotherapy drugs, agents, approaches that are currently undergoing clinical testing. So the field has just been blown wide open by the proof of principle that untangling this biology can have a true transformative effect on patients' lives.
And can I just jump in
here?
We're
just seeing a landslide.
So 2,000 currently in development or in clinical trial?
Different agents from hitting different components of the immune system are all undergoing clinical testing across the world.
And when's the last time cancer research has seen that kind of explosion in potential therapies?
Well, I don't think ever. I mean, this is really a completely new era. And, you know, we really have to acknowledge that why are we here? We're here because there's been a tremendous investment, you know, on the part of our government, on the part of industry, in understanding tumor biology in a very deep level. And that understanding is leading to so many different possibilities for treatment of cancer.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if I want to just inject a little bit of, not skepticism, but perhaps a little caution here, because, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because I remember a while ago, maybe a generation ago, there was a lot of excitement, for example, around Judah Folkman's research in angiogenesis in cancers, thinking like if we sort of figured out a way to block the blood flow to tumors, that would be a way to really get rid of any and all cancers in the body. Very exciting line of research, perhaps didn't yield the kind of treatments that we're seeing now with immunotherapy. Should we continue to have some measure of a grain of salt or skepticism even around this moment of great excitement? I mean, Jamal,
Magna, you couldn't have possibly picked a better example. You know, we didn't plan this, but you know, one of the things I'm sure Dr. Allison will chime in here too is that work that Dr. Folkman did to look at the blood vessels is now being combined with the drugs that Dr. Allison's group has developed came out of his work, and the combination of targeting the blood vessel together with taking the brakes off the T cell is producing even better responses in some tumors. So nothing goes wasted.
Yeah, that's correct. And the one of the things that we're realizing that is coming true is that this immunotherapy can be combined with not only other immunotherapies, but with conventional therapies like chemotherapy and as you said, angiogenesis therapies. And virtually anything that kills tumor cells can be used to prime an immune response. So that's why there's so many combinations out there, so many that we've got to really, you know, have data before deciding to do a combination in any kind of scale, or else we're going to be going down a lot of false leads.
All right. Well, you know, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us because obviously cancer is a huge issue that does have an impact on so many people's lives. You're listening this hour to Jim Allison. He was awarded the 2018 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for his work in cancer immunotherapy. He shares that award with Tatsuko Honjo of Kyoto University. And you're also hearing from Monica Bertagnoli. She's president of the American Society for Clinical Oncology and chief of the Division of Surgical Oncology at Dana-Farber Brigham and Women's Hospital Cancer Center. So we've got a couple of the top researchers in cancer with us this hour. What is your question for them? Let's go to Scott, who's calling from Eagle River, Wisconsin. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi. In 2015, I found a bump on my head, and it came back melanoma. They removed it. They took 3 lymph nodes out, had a trace. They went back in, removed 35 more, and they were clean. And I was good until 2017 when they found some lumps in my nodules in my lung. They removed 3 of them, and 2 had melanoma. So I went on the clinical trial, the IPI and the NIPI, and they had to stop after the 3rd one because it attacked my digestive system.
Uh-huh.
And I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. And, yeah, a lot of side effects. This is the first year that summer that I'm out and about and doing things. They attack my muscles and my joints.
Yeah.
And now I ended up with permanent pseudo gout.
But would you?
Everything is clean, except 3 months ago they found a 3-millimeter tumor in my brain. And they keep checking it, and it's not growing. And it's too deep to go in to get for a biopsy.
Yeah.
So for now, we're keeping an eye on it, and they're thinking the reason why it's not growing, that the medicine is still working in my system. Does that sound correct?
Scott, I want to say thank you so much for your call. Monica Bertagnoli, let me turn back to you. I mean, so Scott saying, I think he's indicating that even with the challenges that he had with the side effects, he would do the immunotherapy all over again. But can we talk a little more specifically about those side effects? I mean, Scott talked about that he was hospitalized because the immunotherapy also ended up attacking his digestive system. He had musculature effects as well. I mean, there are some serious side effects. Might even be too light of a word here for this kind of therapy.
Fortunately, not everyone has bad side effects, but it's way too common, and it's one of the big challenges with use of these therapies. You know, your immune system's there for a reason. It's there to attack abnormal cells, and sometimes when you jazz it up to attack a tumor cell, it's going to start exerting bad effects on normal tissues, and that's the other half of the coin of the immune system. You know, this a whole condition we know as autoimmunity, which is, you know, the opposite side of the picture, and we have a lot to do to understand these toxicities and to continue to work on making immunotherapy very specific for the tumor and to prevent its attacking other tissues. Unfortunately, still happens far too often.
So, Jim Ellis, I mean, that sounds, I don't want to call it a trade-off, but it's part of the complex decision that a cancer patient and his or her medical team have to go through. Because, I mean, what is the overall effectiveness of these treatments? Is it 20%, 30%? And for those folks, are they also facing these serious side effects?
Well, the effectiveness varies from cancer type to cancer type. A combination of the drug that I developed with the subsequent drug that Dr. Hanja developed together has a response rate of 60% in metastatic melanoma in big clinical trials. It's approved now for use, and I think there's no reason to think that won't go out for 10 years. You know, for other cancers, kidney cancer, it's about 30 to 50%. You know, other cancers, it's somewhat lower, but those are with monotherapies, and as the combinations come along, the response rates can go higher. You know, our goal is to get it as close to 100% as we can. But there is, as was said, a trade-off there. It's not like chemotherapy, though, where everybody suffers from the same thing, you know, with every dividing cell in the body gets challenged by the drug. Here it's sporadic, and it's largely diarrhea and things like that, which can most of the time be managed with temporary immunosuppression. But there are a few patients that do develop, you know, bona fide autoimmune situations, and you know, that's we're still working on what to do about those. Yeah. But for most of the patients, it's especially in the hands of a team that has experience. They're pretty well tolerated, actually, compared to chemotherapy or even radiation.
Well, we have another caller who wants to ask about these side effects. Let's go to Patty, who's calling from Westlake, Ohio. Patty, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My daughter was 23 when she was diagnosed with metastatic melanoma and was treated with combo immunotherapies. And she is no longer on them because she developed lymphedema. And so now she's on a drug called Remicade, and they're trying to get it under control because she has swelling and fluid in the lungs. So I was wondering, is there any other treatments, you know, for people that develop, you know, these side effects that possibly could help her out? She's at the clinic, so we know we're with a good team of doctors. We just celebrated her third year of survival. Mm. She was diagnosed yesterday. So, that's my question.
Yeah. Patty, thank you for your call. Jim Ellison?
I think that sounds like, you know, something unfortunate that happens to a lot of people. I think that one of the things that's being done, I mean, I don't know what else can be done to treat that now, but one of the things that a lot of companies and physicians are trying is to, you know, dial the doses down a little bit, particularly in the combinations, because I think that we are probably over-treating a lot of patients now, and, you know, especially when you start giving them both drugs. So As I said, there's a lot of investigations towards decreasing either the total amount of the drug or the number of injections.
Yeah. Monica Bertagnoli, let me turn back to you here for a second, because, again, you were saying earlier about, you know, the immune system, of course, is a body-wide system. Mm-hmm. And just, again, from a layperson's point of view here, help us understand, like, how targeted these treatments are or what direction they're heading in. Like, can we selectively turn on or awaken certain T cells so that they only attack tumor cells, or by turning T cells on, are we sort of doomed to have them be, you know, I don't want to say overactive, but even more active throughout the body in every body system?
Right. You know, it's such a, the wonderful promise of the immune system is its selectivity. You know, we can get we know that the immune system can very precisely identify signals and only attack cells that contain those particular signals. These signals are known as antigens. T cells are tailored by the body to respond to particular antigens. And fortunately, cancers can develop on the surface of their cells very selective antigens that T cells can recognize. So when you have a situation like that, and the signal on the T on the cancer that identifies it as foreign and identifies it as something that the immune system is able to attack, when that signal is only on the cancer cell, we're all set. Unfortunately, when those proteins can be in other places in the body, and when those signals are shared by other tissues in the body, that's where you see the harmful side effects. So that's the goal. Find the specific signal and use that to our benefit.
All right. And would that specific signal change from individual to individual?
Absolutely. That's the other thing we know. Every human being is different.
All right. Well, we're going to talk more about that in a second, because it's a big part of this story. We're talking with Dr. Monica Bertagnoli. She's president of the American Society for Clinical Oncology. And with Jim Allison, he was awarded the 2018 Nobel Prize in Medicine for his research on cancer immunotherapy. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about where we are with cancer research and why there's so much excitement around immunotherapies and cancer treatment. And I'm joined today by the 2018 Nobel Prize winner in Medicine and Physiology. It's Jim Allison. He shared the award with Tasuku Honjo of Kyoto University. Jim Allison is chair of the Department of Immunology at MD Anderson Cancer Center. We're also joined by Monica Bertagnoli. She's president of the American Society for Clinical Oncology. And a little earlier in the show, Dr. Bertagnoli told us that we've never seen an explosion in terms of the number of possible treatments or therapies for cancer as we are seeing seeing right now. Some 2,000 different treatments in the pipeline, the research or clinical trial pipeline, and it's a very exciting moment in cancer research. But Dr. Bertagnoli, just before the break, we were also talking about how individualized these therapies can be. So are we talking about, you know, slightly different therapies tailored for from person to person?
Oh, perhaps. There is a whole emphasis right now on understanding the individual biology of every patient and being able to target that specifically. That not only helps us develop treatments that work better, it helps us develop treatments that have fewer side effects. You know, many examples of this, and it's a general direction I believe we're heading in all of oncology.
I see. Jim Allison, go ahead.
If I could just add, Dr. Bertagnoli was talking about the antigens that T cells recognize. We know now that many of those are generated by mutations that are part of the carcinogenic process itself. And so there's a big effort. I'm involved in some, but there's many, many groups trying to develop rapid ways of genome sequencing as that gets faster and cheaper, to identify possible antigens, make them synthetically, and then give them to patients along with the immune checkpoint blockers, with the immunotherapy, perhaps at much, much lower doses, and focus the response even more tightly on the cancer cells themselves.
Well, Jim Allison and Monica Bertagnoli, we've got a comment here that's come in on our website, and the person wants us to make a point that I wanted to ask you about. Someone says, someone calling themselves Plains Dealers says, I hope that in addition to the brilliant science involved, the show addresses the practical impact. In other words, the prices of these therapies. So Jim, let me just start with you. I mean, I'm seeing hundreds of thousands of dollars as a cost for some of these therapies. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct, and it's too high. It really is. I mean, I can understand some of it because in development, ipilimumab, for example, it changed all the rules, the standard endpoints that you use clinically for evaluating drugs that targeted cancer cells weren't useful anymore. So there are a lot of failed trials because they used the wrong endpoints and et cetera, et cetera. So the developmental costs were amazingly high as well, probably the most expensive ever, I'm not sure. But still, that's no reason to keep those prices up where they are now, because they certainly don't reflect the cost of making the drug itself. So they've got to come down, particularly as we get into combinations. And I all I can hope, I mean, that is outside my area, but I got to hope that they come down fast so that they can get to more patients.
Yeah. Monica Bertagnoli, I know that neither you or Jim are setting prices for drugs that are coming out of clinical trial. I want to acknowledge that. And also, we've heard frequently over the many years, and Jim just pointed to it, that the development costs of these drugs are very high because sometimes we're talking about decades of research. So that point also should be made. But on the other hand, I mean, both of you are in the world of cancer research. Are you concerned that as we have these potentially very game-changing therapies coming out of the pipeline, but because their costs are so high, it could further sort of drive a wedge between the haves and have-nots when it comes to availability and access to healthcare in the United States?
Well, that wedge is there now, Meghna, you know, and it's terrible. And it's something that concerns us every day. And, you know, I think it's a broader discussion than just the cost of some very expensive new, transformative drugs. It's the cost of our entire healthcare system in the United States. And how are we going to focus? What we can do as doctors and as researchers is to focus on getting exactly the right therapies to the right patients in the best, most efficient way. Because then it's not so unreasonable to justify what that's going to cost. What really concerns me even more is when we have waste in the system, or when it's inefficient, or when we don't have the ability to understand who's going to benefit and who's not. And really, as clinicians and researchers, that's where our focus is.
Okay. Well, let's go to Lizzie, who's calling from Jupiter, Florida. Lizzie, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Lizzie. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to counter all this talk of excitement with my experience of frustration over immunotherapy. I'm 52 years old. I was diagnosed with advanced stage 3 ovarian cancer, which statistically has a terrible survival rate. Like I'll be very, very, very lucky if I'm still alive in 5 years. And yet every day on NPR, I hear about these clinics with all this immunotherapy, but there's none for me. And so my question to your researchers is, for someone like me, how many years do I have to try to stay alive using conventional methods of treatment until someone comes up with immunotherapy that's going to prolong my life?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, Lizzie, hang on. Don't hang up the phone here. Let me just turn to Jim Allison first. Jim, do you have a response for her?
Yeah, I mean, one of the excitement about immunotherapy is because there's a lot of cancers that were uniformly fatal before that are now responding. Unfortunately, they don't all respond. I mean, in glioblastoma and pancreatic cancer, for example, that we hear about in the news a lot, really have not responded much at all yet. And ovarian is one which doesn't respond with the frequency we'd like. And so what we're involved in here and in our immunotherapy platform is really studying what goes wrong, not only in patients that have successful therapies, but in patients that receive combinations that don't work, and try to figure out what's missing, and then in a rational way add the things that are missing and try to move it forward to where it makes it more effective. And you know, we've done that in a few cancers now, but ovarian's one where we just haven't made it very far.
Now, Lizzie, did I hear you correctly when you say that you've been searching for a clinical trial to participate in, but you can't find one, or one that you're qualified for?
Yeah, that's correct. I found one, but I don't think they're saying it's a vaccine, but it's like, which I think is different from immunotherapy, but it's also one where there's a 50% chance that I'll get a placebo.
Uh-huh. Right.
I don't know, is a vaccine the same thing as immunotherapy, or is that different?
Okay. Dr.
Well,
Bertignoli,
it's a different kind of immunotherapy.
Yeah. Monica Bertignoli, I mean, what guidance or advice would you have for Lizzie? Because I imagine that there are many other people like her out there who would like to have access to these treatments, even in the clinical trial phase, but for whatever reason cannot.
Well, you know, you have two questions, you know, two issues. First, Lizzie, thank you so much for calling in and for sharing your story with us, because this is something that absolutely needs to be raised every time we have a discussion about some great breakthrough. There's just always so much more to do, and I hope very much that you are in an environment where you have expert doctors who are doing everything they can for you, because you know, there's a lot that can be done, mm-hmm. but there's still a lot more to do. Now, the issue of clinical trials. Again, Lizzie, thank you for illustrating the importance of that. One of the big problems we have, only 3% of patients, adult patients in the United States, participate in clinical trials. So 97% of people out there, we don't have information or even access to them for some of these new potential breakthrough therapies. So one of the big things that we need to advocate for is more availability of clinical trials, and those trials need to get to every tiny community, not just the big cities for people who have insurance.
Yeah. Well, Lizzie, thank you very much for your call, and we hope and wish you all the best as you continue to live with your cancer. So thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Billy, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Billy, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was diagnosed with cancer at Dana-Farber in 1994. That was the same day that my aunt died from her chemotherapy treatments. So after I started getting chemotherapy, I had a belief that I'd just get really sick and it would kill me. I was 16 and I decided to just, you know, take chances and, like, I'd rather die from the cancer than from the chemotherapy.
Yeah.
So I left. I grabbed, you know, my skateboard and got on a Greyhound bus and left to just go, like, live. Well, after receiving nationwide media attention for being a runaway cancer patient, I learned about all different alternative therapies. I ended up doing one that they said it boosts your immune system so your body can, you know, heal the cancer the way it's supposed to.
And what was that alternative therapy?
Well, I changed my diet. I drank a tea to help get the toxins out. But the therapy that I chose was, it was called 714X, and you inject it into your lymph nodes. And when I was 16, I learned how to do the injections. But
where did you get the therapy from?
From Canada.
Okay. And now, and that was in 94, and now we're in 2018. So you're saying that it worked for you?
I'm saying that I'm 16 and I'm 40 now. So there's that. But the thing that no one could ever tell me, which I always, if it wasn't an approved drug, there wasn't much like research done on it. But when I learned about it, I believed that it was what my body needed. My immune system.
Well,
instead of like poisoning myself, I think I'll have a better chance.
Billy, thank you for your call. I definitely want to turn that back to Monica Bertagnoli and Jim Allison. And Monica, let me start with you. I mean, Billy's not the only person who brings this up. We've got stuff coming in online of people wanting to talk about alternative treatments, including vitamin C or preventative measures, dietary changes, that kind of thing. So, I mean, what's your response to Billy about alternative treatments?
So, first of all, we practice our medicine based on the best knowledge we have. And the best knowledge we have comes from data. It comes from studies of patients where we actually try different therapies in clinical trials in patients and gather data on whether they are going to respond or not. Any given patient that receives a therapy, it's never a sure thing. The other really important issue that the alternative therapy approach raises is that as doctors, we absolutely have to practice our medicine in a way that includes and is respectful to the patient's interests, the patient's values, and their desires, whether it's to grab your skateboard and be a teenager, mm-hmm. or whether it's to try some other therapies. We try to guide it in a way that's not going to hurt what we know is the best thing to do. But ultimately, it's the patient's journey. We're there to support and help in the best way we can. And the last thing we want to do is to turn them off or turn them away because they might have a different idea about something.
Yeah. Jim Allison, do you have a thought on that?
No, I agree 100% with what she said. We do things, I'm a scientist, not a physician, but we all try to do things based on data and our understanding of how things work and what works.
Well, we've just got a couple minutes left here to wrap up the show. And Jim Allison, since you said you're a scientist, not a physician, I was just wondering if you might talk to us a little bit about all the other scientists who've been working on immunotherapies in cancer, because this is one thing that I think, the Nobel Prize does a great job at acknowledging great work and focusing, the public's broader attention on things that are happening in science and medicine in particular. But I hope you don't mind me saying, but I presume you're not the only person who's had a big impact in this field.
No, I'm the way that science and there is I work in works is we have students and postdoctoral fellows, and we direct their efforts and as a team, approach things. And I'd have to give you a long list of people that contributed to this, but a lot of this work was done. The foundation for this stuff was done in the mid-90s, actually, by some graduate students in my lab at the University of California at Berkeley at the time. And I have to give them a lot of credit, most notably a guy named Max Crummell, who was the guy that did the cool experiments that showed that CTLA-4 was the brakes on the immune system.
Mm-hmm. And Monica Bertagnoli, I mean, to that point, there are many people out there working on this. There's labs across the United States and around the world. What do you think is the best thing that the public could do to further support, enhance, advance this research?
So I think it's incredibly important that the public understand the value of participating in clinical trials research, working with physician researchers who are trying to advance these new therapies. All the wonderful discoveries in the laboratory don't mean much to human beings unless we can have patients, partner with us to really test them and study them. So that's one way where people can make a tremendous difference in the world, in hopefully for themselves, but also even if not, for the world and future cancer patients, you know. And then finally, a lot of research is supported by the government, mm-hmm. and continued public support for the type of research that has led to these breakthroughs that comes out of our public funding is really important, really something we'd like to see our citizens continue to advocate for.
Yeah. Well, Monica Bertagnoli, president of the American Society for Clinical Oncology and chief of the Division of Surgical Oncology at Dana-Farber Brigham and Women's Hospital Cancer Center, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Magna. It's been great.
And Jim Allison, the 2018 Nobel Prize winner in Physiology or Medicine, an award that he shares with Tasuku Honjo of Kyoto University. Jim Allison is also chair of the Department of Immunology at MD Anderson Cancer Center. Mr. Allison, thank you so much for joining us today, and congratulations on the Nobel Prize and all your research. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for giving me the chance to do this.
And by the way, folks, if you've been wondering why I've been calling Jim Allison Mr. Allison and not Dr. Allison, he is Jim Allison, PhD, but our journalistic standards here at NPR say MDs get called doctors, PhDs get PhDs, I guess. So that's a quick explanation there. But go to our website, onpointradio.org, if you've got thoughts about cancer treatments today and immunotherapies as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.